Welcome back to the Zero Pressure podcast series, a relaxed conversation with those on the cutting edge of science and technology, hosted by me, Helen Sharman, and presented by Imperial College London and Saab. The Zero Pressure podcast series is looking at how science and technology positively can contribute to solving complex, interrelated global challenges of today and tomorrow. In this special edition of the Zero Pressure podcast, we'll discuss mapping of the Earth's oceans. It's been said that the ocean is the Earth's final frontier, for good reason. With telescopes, astronomers can see objects that are now 13 billion light years away from Earth. Closer to home, we've mapped 90% of the surface of Mars and the entire Moon's surface, yet only a quarter of Earth's oceans have been mapped. How can ocean maps be used to solve problems as wide-ranging as energy, defence and climate change? As well as my studio guests today, we'll be hearing recordings of the panellists from a Zero Pressure live event at London's Royal Geographical Society, part of the 2023 Great Exhibition Road Festival. So I'm very pleased to be joined today in the studio by Professor Jenny Collier. Jenny is a Professor of Marine Geophysics at Imperial College London with broad interests in geology, geophysics and geodynamics. She specialises in marine methods and often goes to sea on expeditions to collect data that has transformed our understanding of Earth science, including the process by which the island of Britain became isolated from continental Europe. Jenny says the oceans are what makes Earth unique. Jenny, what actually got you interested in marine research?
That's an interesting one. I think it was partly to do with timing. So I was a graduate student in the early 80s when really the plate tectonic revolution, which is really the underpinning theory for earth science, had really taken off. And I was in the place where there'd been a major discovery towards it, and it was all about the oceans. And so it seemed like the hottest place to be.
Have you ever been caught out by the weather at sea?
Oh, well, always. And so the thing is, you know, people often ask me about, you know, do you get seasick? Oh, I'm never seasick. Well, you're almost always a little bit ill after day two. And it's to do with something to do with your inner ear. But basically, once you've got over that, when it gets really rough, it actually, you know, can be strangely enjoyable. So I've been in many situations where you're walking down on the floor, then at some point you're actually walking on the wall, and then you're walking on the floor again because the ship is rolling.
Goodness.
That much. So yeah, of course it's I'm saying that slightly jokingly. Of course, if you've got instruments on the seabed which might be coming up to the surface, then you've got real problems. But of course, you know, weather forecasting has become better and better with time, so you usually know that it's coming.
This motion sickness is the same in space, of course. We get often the first few days of feeling weightless because of that inner ear changes, and then it tends to settle down. But not all astronauts experience it, so only some actually feel nauseous and some don't. It's something to do with the balance between the ears.
And do you feel it worse when you get off?
So those astronauts who are space sick tend to be earth sick when they come back.
Yeah, I often feel worse when I get off the ship, which is really weird. So when you get off, everything is moving. I mean, people probably think I'm drunk, but everything is moving around. I mean, so it's something medical.
Now, we'll come to the how in a minute, but why is it so important that we study the seafloors?
Well, of course, it is, you know, two-thirds of our planet. And so, you know, if you think about my field, which is earth science, you know, the early geologists just ignored the oceans. And of course, we could continue ignoring the oceans. But of course, they're a critical part of our planet in terms of resources, you know, particularly as we go into the green economy, biological reserves, and so on. So it's you know, you ask, why study? I say, well, why wouldn't you? I mean, it's you need a specific technology, which is why, you know, I'm a marine geophysicist. That's why I have a special, you know, adjective to the front of my job description. But it's absolutely a critical part of how the Earth system works, particularly with, you know, climate, in, for example, going forward.
So what technologies do we use at the moment to map the oceans? You know, how accurate are they now?
Yeah, so in terms of, you know, when you say map, I assume you meaning measuring the bathymetry. So it's making a topographic map. I mean, that's the most fundamental way of what we call mapping. So what makes the Earth unique, I mean, compared to the other planets. So, of course, the planets have been successfully mapped by satellites. So in a satellite, you orbit around the planet and you emit a sensor, and you basically can measure the topography directly. On Earth, we have the problem of the water blanket. So the frequencies that you'd use from a satellite can't get through the water. And that's really what makes Earth unique, and actually is why we actually understand less about the seafloor of our own planet than our neighbouring rocky planets. I mean, it's an extraordinary fact, but it is a fact. So we can do it with the satellite, but on the Earth, the satellite radar can only bounce off the sea surface. And so the sea surface is attracted by gravity, actually, to the topography. So you can only get a very crude estimate, if you like, of the bathymetry.
Okay, so we can't look at it from just radar bouncing off the surface.
Yes.
So how do we get through all that water?
Yeah, so the only way to get through the water is to use sonar, so sort of typically about 100 kilohertz. And we do that from basically having an instrument mounted on the bottom of a boat. So you have to be in contact with the water, and you emit the sonar, or the sound energy, if you like. So just like a whale communicates very long distances across water.
Now, 100 kilohertz, sort of quite how high or low? I mean, can you actually hear that?
You can hear it. And so sort of the prototypes, the older versions that we used, say, when I was a PhD student, they actually were housed in a yellow body, and they actually sound a little bit like a dolphin, if you've ever heard a dolphin make a noise at a water park.
Yeah, sort of chirrup, chirrup. Exactly.
And often when we were towing them, dolphins would actually be attracted to them, and sometimes they would swim along with you for several days, sort of chirping. I know, it was very cute. It actually made the data unusable, but it was very cute. So it's that sort of noise. And so, you know, in the oceans, these frequencies can travel. Obviously, the water has a lot of diffractors, a lot of particles in it, but it's sort of the ideal frequency to use to transmit energy long distances.
Okay. So a single sonar beam and then bounces back. I'm just starting to think it presumably it's going to reflect, it's going to get a bit diffuse. How high a resolution can we actually do this mapping?
Yeah, so the footprint on the seafloor actually isn't your biggest problem. Your biggest problem is that you're bobbing around in a boat. And so you have to have quite sophisticated gyroscopes to basically correct for the pitch, heave and roll of the vessel. So that is something that has really caused the breakthrough of these multi-beam echo sounders, the ability to basically have higher precision navigation, GPS, to correct for that. So you're right, there is we call it the footprint on the seabed, but that isn't your biggest problem.
Okay, but multi-beam echo sounders. So it's not just one little sort of beep of sonar that goes on and come back. So how does this work then?
Yeah, so that was really the breakthrough. So on the bottom of the ship, you'll basically have an array sort of installed in a dry dock, and it will often have about 240 pings. So it's like a fan. And I say sometimes we use this description, mowing the lawn.
I love that
phrase. Because it's basically you get 100% coverage along that strip. And that's really what revolutionised the technology compared to what they were doing, say, in the 1980s, 1990s, when indeed you would just have single points and you'd contour them. But now we have a 2D data set. So obviously, once you've collected all of the raw data, you can process it and you can, for example, smooth it slightly. So look at what the values of the neighbouring pings are. So we do quite a lot of ping editing. So obviously, it can, you know, we can get bad data, which we can remove by various algorithms. And typically we would end up with a grid which would have a pixel size of about 100 metres either side. And, you know, the vertical resolution would be about, let's say, 5 metres.
So is there a way we can actually get this resolution better? I mean, you'd like it better, wouldn't you, for your studies?
Well, yes, of course you would, particularly if you're studying something which is, you know, smaller than your 100-metre cell size. So the only way to increase the resolution would be to put your sonar system on an ROV, or remotely operated vehicle. And so an ROV basically is a separate unit which you tow from the ship. So usually it's on a cable and it's sending its data back to the ship. And you can basically lower it down so that it's closer to the target. So it's a bit like taking a dog for a walk, actually. You're on the ship and you've got this thing and you can, you know, it has a little bit of ability to move around, but it's basically sending the data usually back up.
Although the use of AUVs and ROVs has been increased drastically, crewed or manned submersibles are still an important part of our overall exploration strategy. The dangers of underwater exploration were brought into the global spotlight with the tragic loss of the crew of the Titan submersible. Here's Abby Wilson, curator of transport and mobility at the Science Museum. This was recorded before the Titan went missing.
There's something to be said, and a lot of marine scientists and underwater explorers talk about this, about being there in person yourself and actually seeing it. I think James Cameron, who is the Hollywood film director, but also has done loads of underwater exploration, which is two jobs that I didn't really think went together. But he's talked about it as sort of like witnessing. So actually being there, and there's just something to be said for actually doing marine science in its natural setting. And even with all the technology that we have of cameras and all of that, actually the quality is not as good as seeing it with your own eyes. And there's also issues around sort of depth perception and things, so you can see that a lot easier by just turning your head, and the visual information changes as you do that if you're there. But if you've got a camera, you have to actually get the camera to move, rather than you can't just move your head and while still looking at the sort of screen of information. So I think it's just both sort of the physical thing of being there, and but also like actually you're getting more sort of observation data out of it.
For the future then of bathymetry, can you see it being yet more work with sonar? Is there anything, any other wild new technology coming out, or are we going to work more perhaps with artificial intelligence and perhaps the machine learning aspect of it?
Yes, I mean, I think we have a physical issue with the water. So we have, you know, water which is very scattering and absorbing of energy. So there, that's a fundamental limitation. But no doubt in the future, we can make, particularly as we go into automated methods, we can make them more intelligent and to be able to, you know, recognize features. Because, I mean, that's ideally what you want them to do if you're mapping a certain feature. So, for example, in the oceans, connectivity of habitat is really important, just like it is on land. So, you know, you worry about removing forests for monkeys, and the point is that they then need to be able to migrate to another forest.
Sure.
So they can.
Mm.
And the exactly same is true for benthic organisms as well. But for example, you could have a more intelligent sensor which could perhaps then track a given feature and therefore determine what the continuity of a particular environment on the seabed was, which at the moment you'd need to rely on a human,
yes,
you know, dictating where that most likely is going to be.
Most of us are familiar with what I would call the beautiful, magnificent mountains on the surface of the, let's say, above the sea. You know, we're familiar with the Everest, and we've got beautiful mountains all over the world. But what do you think are the most impressive topographical features under the oceans?
The obvious answer to that would be, you know, you've talked about Everest, would be to go for the Challenger Deep. So that is the deepest place on Earth. But what's really remarkable is that it was discovered by the HMS Challenger 150 years ago. So completely sort of by accident, you know, remembering they were doing this by lowering a chain and counting the knots on the chain. completely by accident, they happened to do one of their spot measurements in the deepest part of the ocean.
Oh, they lost, they ran out of chain.
Well, obviously, people thought, of course, when you're lowering a chain, it can very easily be drifting off. So I'm sure they thought it was wrong. And I haven't actually read the memoir, but I bet you they were told to redo it and this is not possible. So that's, in terms of serendipity, that's sort of extraordinary. But in terms of features, I mean, I think the most remarkable features are the mid-ocean ridge system. So this is the continuous chain of volcanoes, which lies in the middle of the ocean. So, for example, in the middle of the mid-Atlantic ridge. And what's really remarkable about them, so this is where new seafloor is continually being made and is pushing North America away from Europe, for example, in plate tectonics. But what's remarkable about them is that they're continuous around the planet. So they actually, when you get down to the South Atlantic, they actually nip around South America and then into the Indian Ocean. They become the Southwest Indian Ridge. So they're a continuous system. I mean, no mountain, I'm going to brag my marine credentials here, no, you know, mountain range on land does that. I mean, they're just the, by far the longest, most continuous features on Earth.
So amazing natural topographical features. But we also have quite a lot of what I call artificial features, especially nowadays, don't we? How reliant are we on this infrastructure on the seafloor?
I mean, people would be surprised how many cables. So telecommunications is still dominantly by cable. People tend to think it's satellite, but actually it's not. And this is a hazard. So my most routine work involves putting instruments on the seabed. And so we always have to check in great detail for the, you know, the possibility there might be cables down there, and then we avoid them. But it's a whole industry is actually in terms of surveying. So they actually have, they use sonar, of course, to inspect the integrity of cables, lay cables, repair bits of cables, and so on and so forth. And of course, going into the, you know, the green economy, offshore wind farms will become much more common. Sort of artificial reef sites, perhaps for either, you know, for commercial systems such as lobsters and so on. You know, we're likely to be using our continental shelves, you know, more and more as we face, you know, challenges with climate change.
Underwater exploration has often been driven by commercial rather than purely scientific interests, and some of our most critical national infrastructure is placed on the ocean floors. Here's Chris Lade, underwater defence specialist at Saab Dynamics.
Okay, I think it's true, you know, the driver behind a lot of this exploration is financial, commercial. The infrastructure that we have now on the seabed, if you go back from what Challenger was doing, which was laying communications cables, we still have communications cables on the seabed, but they are far more extensive. So 97% of internet communications come over the seabed. In addition to cables that deliver data, there are cables out there that deliver power, energy. So those are two aspects. And the other aspect is sort of largest factor is the oil and gas commercial business and the delivery of oil and gas through pipelines. But more than that, the operation of oil and gas companies and the infrastructure they need to conduct that operation, all of which can be sensitive to a range of different problems, not least of which the environment itself. But going forward, I think it will be the commercial world that drives additional infrastructure, the sort of we've seen now, obviously, the wind farms. Wind farms produce energy. They need to get that energy ashore. They need to be controlled. And the way to do that is through underwater cabling.
Right. So it's important to remember when we talk about energy that we're not just talking about oil and gas.
No, absolutely. Yeah. And more, and obviously, as we move to a greener environment, the ability to deliver tidal energy is another example where you can generate the energy, but you've got to get that energy ashore. So you're going to need to transmit that energy. We talk about fish farms, fish farming. That it's all underwater infrastructure or marine infrastructure that we're talking about here. Okay. And it's driven very much by the commercial world. Yeah. Although from a defence perspective too, of course, defence needs to communicate and they use similar cables to communicate. There might be a special cable with a high security, but that therefore makes it potentially vulnerable to attack. And then again, sensor systems that you might want to deploy onto the seabed to deliver a picture of what's going on in your backyard from a defence perspective.
Tell me a bit more about how ocean mapping contributes to our understanding of climate change.
I mean, obviously, a factor of climate change is that we're going to have sea level rise, and so this is going to put an unexpected pressure on the particularly on the shallow water areas. So if you're going to double the water depth, that puts is going to change the whole hazard potential, if you like. So possibly there's going to be more landsliding, for example. As we warm up the oceans, we have large amounts of gas hydrate, which actually is in a frozen form on a lot of our continental shelves.
A frozen form of?
Of methane. And so there's a double danger there that we that gets above its stability zone and it's going to gas. So that's going to also release methane, but it's also then going to destabilize the, so I'm sounding a bit doom and gloomy, but destabilize the continental shelves as well. So there's, in terms of building resilience for sort of the immediate 10, 20 years going forward of climate change, it's going to be even more critical to be monitoring our coastal seas. Mm.
During the live event we had, you discussed collapsing seashells at length there. I mean, what causes these collapses?
So there are some very famous examples actually in the North Sea during the last ice age, and the concern is that we know that we have basically crystallized methane, or it's like a gas hydrate crystallized, and the concern is that if we, first of all, we increase the water depth because of sea level rise, and also with the waters getting warmer, particularly, this is really well recorded now, on the shelves are getting warmer year on year, that we could actually destabilize these gas hydrates, which of course would make things worse because they release methane, but more importantly, they could arguably, they could possibly destabilize the continental shelves themselves, which would give large landslides into the deep water, which actually may well cause a tsunami. So there's a very famous example in the North Sea. And so, for example, some boulders have been discovered on land in Scotland, which are thought to be a result of, you know, a significant collapse of the continental shelf.
Wow.
At a particular time.
So where did they come from, these boulders exactly?
Well, you've got to think about when a major landslide happens. I mean, it's a major movement of earth materials. And if you're in a confined basin like you were in the North Sea, then right. Basically things can get funneled and tunneled.
Okay, right.
And then the material can just end up on the shore.
Amazing.
I mean, the earth is an amazing organism.
And it's got so much information just crying out to be found, isn't it?
It has. You have to be a detective, though. I often think being an earth scientist is a bit like being a... You've got to look for all the clues and re-put... You know, you've had to visit the scene of the crime and try and put all the pieces together.
Mapping of the oceans and expanding our understanding of the seafloor is vital for defence. Here's Michael Brasseur, Saab Vice President and Chief Strategy Officer.
The oceans that connect us all power the global economy and now are primed for innovation and discovery. There's a recognition here just how valuable the oceans are, not only to our economies, but to our security. And so then there's a desire to protect this critical asset. But in order to protect it, you need to see it. And so we at NATO, I used to work at the US mission to NATO and was part of the NATO Maritime Unmanned Systems Initiative. And we started iterating on this idea of a digital ocean. So the entering argument is the recognition just how important the oceans are and a desire to protect them, a desire to see them in order to protect them. So we looked at this holistically from seabed to space, and I think we'll cover those domains here. And what we were endeavoring to do was leverage existing sensors from seabed to space, and then weave in exciting new maritime robotics above, on, and below the water, fuse that data, and then exploit that data with machine learning and artificial intelligence to go beyond, in the military, what we call maritime domain awareness towards maritime domain cognition. An understanding so rich of the maritime environment that we aren't just aware of what's happening, we are anticipating and preventing malign activity from happening. So, you know, for me, I was most recently focused on the waters surrounding the Arabian Peninsula, and there's a lot of malign activity, everything from piracy to illegal fishing, but also you have one-way weapons shipments, and so there's a desire to understand so you can prevent malign activity from happening, and you can keep those critical choke points open for commerce. So that's the perspective I come at it with. In addition to, you're also gathering key data about the environment itself, which can be so helpful in solving the climate issue.
So you said see to protect, but you don't mean see with your eyes, do you?
I mean see with every sense we have, all the senses. And so eyes, ears, nose, you know, anything that can gather information about our world's oceans is valuable to protecting them.
So you're sending sensors underwater?
Yes.
And tell me a bit more about the up-to-date technologies, the AI stuff that you can use with it.
Yeah, so really, while the data points are interesting in themselves, and you can see them here, what's most interesting is when all these disparate data points come together, and then you're able to leverage machine learning and AI to detect patterns. And then, you know, patterns that possibly humans couldn't detect. And then you start to, you know, project forward what these patterns mean. And so this is the real interesting thing of all these sensors coming together. And we actually, you know, we at Task Force 59, we actually delivered, you know, 4 digital ocean prototypes while I was there. My chief technology officer would say 2 prototypes and 2 minimal viable products. So we did what I just talked about. And it's early days, but you're starting to see the value of all of that information coming together on a single pane of glass.
Okay, Jenny, so this is a quick fire part of the podcast now.
All right, I'm standing by.
What is your dream expedition location?
Currently, I'd like to go to the Scotia Arc, which is south of Argentina. Challenging place to go, but great science to be found there.
What's special about there?
So it's rather unique, and it's the second subduction zone we have in the Atlantic.
When will we consider the oceans to be fully mapped, do you think?
To a reasonable standard, perhaps 20 years.
What's the incentive to actually getting all of the seafloor mapped?
Well, that's the issue, because of course there's large areas of the ocean which are in international waters, and so that really requires a scientific underpinning rather than a sort of economic or political one.
Thank you, Jenny. I mean, for such a wonderful discussion about mapping the seafloor. It makes me feel actually it's a bit a question of really so near and yet so far. But it's just fascinating to think how much information there is about the planet and how much more we could find out if only we could just get that little bit more data.
I know, the oceans are our, you know, biggest asset, but they're also our biggest hindrance.
Jenny gave us an appreciation of how little we still understand the oceans, which is ironic given the Earth's surface is 2/3 water, something astronauts comment on when they talk about the blue planet. But it's the water itself that makes detecting what is below it so difficult. Jenny talked about multi-beam sonar, now being used to map the highs and lows of the ocean floor at depth, which ties together Earth's past, present and future from Earth's crust formation, the infrastructure that helps modern society to operate, to mitigating climate change. Thank you for joining us on this podcast. I look forward to our next discussion. In the meantime, I leave you with this thought from Arthur C. Clarke. How inappropriate to call this planet Earth when it is clearly ocean.